Welcome to the GeoMob Podcast, where we discuss geo-innovation in any and all forms, whether for fun or profit.
Hello, and welcome back to the GeoMob Podcast. I'm hoping that we have something a little bit different for you today. We're going to be talking hydrometry, and I don't think that's a one-humped camel. With that, I welcome Nick Everard to the podcast. Nick, hi there, and could you maybe just tell the listeners a little bit about who you are?
Yeah, okay. Well, once I get my hilarity under control from the pun. I'm Nick Everard. My job title is Senior Hydrometric Scientist, and I work at the UK Centre for Ecology and Hydrology. But rather more meaningfully, what I do is I've dedicated my life, really, since the age of about 17, believe it or not, to trying to measure flow rates in the world's rivers, and more specifically, to try to find better ways to do that. I'm always motivated by seeing something and finding a way to make it better. So, and for river flow, as hopefully we're going to find out during this podcast, there's quite a lot of potential for improving things and really delivering some big changes to what we do in that area.
That's excellent. So, yeah, I mean, I guess just thinking about it off the top of my head, there's a lot of geospatial that's involved in terms of measuring rivers. I mean, first off, there's where the river is, but also I guess it really matters about where you take your measurements and things like that, which I'm sure we'll get into.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, so I think increasingly we're aware of that. I mean, as with property, as they've always said with property, location, location, location are the three important things. So for measuring river discharge, a discharge and flow, interchangeable terms, for measuring river discharge, where you do that measurement is critically important, because you can get a good measurement or a bad measurement according to where you choose to do your measurement. But also, rivers are very changeable things. You know, tomorrow I'm going to be going out doing a measurement of the River Thames, but where I'm going to be standing to do that measurement with a remote control boat, I'm probably going to be standing in about half a meter to a meter of water, whereas the last time I deployed, I had to put the boat 2 meters down into the water. So, yeah, it changes a lot, and the optimum place to make your measurement will change a lot along with those flow conditions.
Right. Well, you've already mentioned remote control boat, which has already got me my interest piqued. And I know that you do a lot of work with satellites and drones and other things. I was wondering, before we get into all the tech stuff, maybe you could give us just a very quick overview of sort of the history, maybe, of measuring flow. Because back in the day when I was an undergrad geographer, which is a long time ago now, it was basically chuck an orange peel in somewhere and then measure how long it takes to go down a certain distance to the river. But I guess there's been a lot of technological advances since then.
Well, as you'll find out, we're going back to the orange peel in a way. We've now got sort of, or poo sticks. We also sometimes call it poo sticks, electronic poo sticks. But yeah, so when I started as a boy hydrometrist in 1987, the state of the art was to stand in a river or get into a boat and deploy from that boat or next to your wellies, what we call a rotating element current meter. And what that was like a propeller, except it's rotated by the flow of the water. So you place it into the water, and the faster the flow of the water, the more times it would revolve in a period of time. And you would count those revolutions on a little counter box, which frequently would go wrong, get water in it, batteries would go flat, it would stop working. And you would write these numbers down in a little notebook, which was very often getting more and more soggy from the rain, disintegrating. On larger rivers, we used to hang this thing off bridges on a sort of winch system with a 25 kilo sinker weight on it. So if that ever bumped you on the head as you were passing underneath the bridge, you'd know about it and you'd be rather upset. But yeah, for large rivers, also for the Thames, frequently we would take a manned boat. We should call it a crewed boat nowadays to be non-gender specific, but a crewed boat sounds to me like something that's like not a very good boat. But we would take a boat, we would have three people in it, we would stretch a cable across the river, which we would winch tight with a big winch system, and then we would take about 2 or 3 hours to do measurements with this propeller system off the side of the boat. Sometimes we had five of these things on a 7 meter long aluminium pole, which we would try and deploy off the front, which was fine in low flows, but some of the most important measurements we can make are during high flows and floods. Mm. And during high flows and floods, it was almost impossible and very dangerous to hang onto that pole. But the other thing, of course, stretching a cable across the river, we've effectively closed the river to navigation. So it was quite time-consuming, quite obstructive. We once had a rowing crew that became very upset by our activities and literally threatened to tear us limb from limb if we ever went and measured the Thames in the path of their rowing again. So, yeah, luckily we've moved on a bit from there. But, I mean, so to continue the journey, we move from those what we called physical meters or mechanical meters. Around about 2002, I was the first in my office to get a connection to the internet. Can you imagine? Having got this connection to the internet, I start looking around to see what's the best, the latest method of measuring river flow. And I found that in the USA, USGS, United States Geological Survey, roughly equivalent to the Environment Agency or SEPA in this country, had started to use acoustic systems known as acoustic Doppler current profilers. So that's a system, it's a bit like a sonar, but it puts pulses down into the water, measures the depth of the water, but it measures the speed using the Doppler principle, which is the principle where the apparent frequency of sound is shifted depending on whether the source or the receiver of the sound is moving. So in this case, pulse sound goes in the water, bounces off particles that are moving through the water column, comes back with a frequency shift that's proportional to the speed of the water. The really nice thing about these systems, well, there were several really nice things about them. One, it gives you data for a very large percentage of the cross-section of the river. So instead of just getting readings for a little point, which you get with a current meter, you're actually getting a profile of velocity, hence the P, the profiler, all the way from the top to the bottom, minus a little bit at the top and the bottom where it can't quite measure. But you're getting an awful lot of data. The other really nice thing was we could deploy these things with ropes. So we could hang them off a bridge on a little floating platform and move them across, or we could get ropes and have some on either side of the river. Then around about 2009, we bought a remote control boat from a company in the USA that developed these boats very close to where the sensors are made. And the boat, it was great. It proved that we could make measurements with a remotely controlled floating platform, but we had a few issues with it, largely that it was probably designed to go in the back of an American F-150 pickup truck, if you've ever seen one of those things. They're pretty big. It wouldn't go in our cars. Anyway, so cut a long story short, I strolled across the drive from where I worked at the Environment Agency at the time in Wallingford to see HR Wallingford, Hydraulics Research, to ask them if they fancied building us a remote control boat. And happily, they did. So a couple of years later, we had what we call the ARC boat, which stands for Acoustic Remote Control Boat. And that enables us to deploy these sensors at way more locations. It means we don't have to go out in the river in a boat. We don't have to be on a bridge, which can be potentially hazardous in extreme floods. It enables us to get much better measurements, but it also enables us to start to do things like mapping the river channel. So because we, around about the same time, we started to put GPS on board, high-precision GPS, we could actually map the river channel, both for bathymetry and kind of uniquely for velocity, so we could see where the fast flowing sections were and where the slow flowing sections were. So yeah, it was a real big improvement. You should probably say something soon because I've spoken for a long time, but we do need to get to that circularity that takes us back to orange peel.
Oh, definitely. No, that's fascinating, particularly so putting GPS onto the boat and being able to, I guess you just manually control it as you would a little model boat on a it's a boating lake type of thing. Okay. What sort of challenges were there about putting GPS, in the early days, putting GPS onto the boat, and also, I guess, then getting the data off and being confident that it was where you said it was and that it tallied up with the acoustic results as well?
Yeah. Well, of course, one potential issue, rivers are always going to be in valleys. So they maybe don't have the best sky view. Right. We can be working close to bridges and that can compromise the results. We would sometimes worry about multipath and so on. Another problem was that initially, I think to support the user community to enable them flexibility, often you would buy your ADCP and you would buy your GPS from separate suppliers. It was up to the user to integrate them. So the communications could be really quite problematic. But around about 2010, this is where things really sort of started to change. Systems with GPS integrated into them became available, and that made things much simpler. And the GPS works really, really nicely. And the other thing you can use it for is, because these systems, by default, they are also what we call pinging. They're sending a pulse of sound to the bed of the river, and they're tracking their own movement over the bed of the river using a Doppler shift in that pulse of sound that goes to the bottom. In extreme floods and other conditions in certain parts of the world, the bed of the river can actually appear to be moving. So this isn't generally the bedrock moving, but you'll right. get gravels and sand in suspension near the bottom, sometimes larger rocks and boulders moving along. That bias is the result. So the GPS was also there to help solve that problem. But it also brought a few problems because, for reasons I won't go into because it gets quite complicated, heading becomes really important. Once you've got GPS on board, your water direction and your boat direction come from different sources and it can compromise the results.
Okay, that's really fascinating. So before we move on to the stuff that I'm really interested in hearing about, which is some of the Earth observation stuff, I guess it would be useful to know why you're doing some of this research. So is it purely to advance knowledge around rivers and floods and that sort of thing? Or is it to, with climate change as something that's hitting now, obviously we've seen examples of that and it's likely to get much worse in the future. Is the research applicable to not only understanding how floods might sort of evolve, I guess, in different parts of the world, but also how we might be able to cope with them?
Yeah, I think you just described it very well there, Albert. the thing you left out at the start there is, number one, because it's fun and exciting.
Well, yes, there is that.
So as we'll come on to, you know, we've progressed from standing in the river with a current meter to ADCPs on remote control boats. We're now using drones and satellites. So it's an exciting field to be in. But yeah, you're absolutely right. The primary reason for making these measurements is actually to calibrate and validate river flow measurement stations. So as I mentioned earlier, I used to work for the Environment Agency. Now they operate a very good, very comprehensive network of river flow monitoring stations all around the country. They have something like 1,700 river flow monitoring stations. So calibrating those and making sure they're giving the right numbers, making sure that when a flood warning is issued, it's issued for good reason. Understanding peak discharge in times of floods, really important, but also low flows, knowing that there's enough water there to be abstracted for reservoirs. The potential is there. The pumps are powerful enough to dry up certain rivers. If they don't know the flow rate, they don't know how much they can extract. But, you know, to come to the climate change thing, yeah, I think, you know, that's really important. I mean, it's a scary place where we're in right now, but I think it makes the work that I and others are involved in all the more important. And it demonstrates that we need new tools and new techniques, which is kind of a nice lead to the drones and the satellites. The boats are fabulous, but when you see a really savage flood, the type we saw in Valencia or even Storm Desmond from 2015 in the UK, the boats are not going to cope. They're going to be washed away. So you need other methods. Yeah. So that's kind of the focus of my work, is to try to find the methods that fit the changing climate that's bringing bigger and more destructive floods.
Yeah, which very nicely brings us on to the things that I want to talk about, which is the satellites. Now, very kindly, you shared some slides from a talk with me earlier today, and I was looking at the video you had of, I think it was a river in Pakistan where you had some measurements from. Could you maybe just talk us a little bit about basically how you got into the idea of using video and what you can do with it? And what are the sort of the benefits of using video from space or from drone, sure. I guess.
Okay. Well, I mean, the first thing I should say, this is the satellite. This is satellite orange peel. This is satellite poo stick. So when we're using video to try to measure river flow speed, it basically is poo sticks. It's basically orange peel. We're sensing, we're trying to detect the motion of the water surface. And the history of this really comes from probably a few researchers around the world. There was a group in France doing some really good work on this. I think the originator was in Japan, a professor Fujita, who developed these methods quite some time ago, at least 10, 15 years ago. People found that if they put a camera on a bridge or shot a video with their phone, once you had rectified the imagery, once you'd sort of transformed it to deal with the oblique view so that it was akin to looking straight down, it then became possible to resolve the movement, the features on the water surface in that video. So the progression of this moved to drones. So low-cost drones started to become available 5-10 years ago. And, of course, once you've got a drone, you can position it optimally above the river, and you can look straight down right from the outset. So looking straight down means you don't have any geometric distortion to deal with, virtually none. And so it really simplifies the processing. So as long as you can get this drone above a section of the river where you've got visible features moving, and this can be debris, it can be leaf litter, but it can be roughness features, it can be foam, any of those kind of things, it works really well. I should say at this point, you cannot calculate river discharge based on that surface velocity, though. You need to know the cross-sectional area, which you can't. Right. Well, there are some tools that can give you an indication of cross-sectional area, but essentially, we need to feed that in. We need to provide that from some other source. But provided we've got that, and the best source of that is our ADCPs, then if we capture a video with the drone, it works really well. But to the part you're really excited about and you really want me to talk about, of course, is the satellite thing. So I'm going to name somebody here. I'm going to give credit. The credit here is due to Mark Randall. He is a Brit, but he's working out in Queensland, Australia with the Queensland government. I was at an ADCP conference with Mark something like 8 years ago, and I knew he'd started using video to measure river flows. And he told me, he'd heard of a company called Planet Labs who could shoot video from space. And as I tell it, and it's almost true, you know, once I picked myself up off the floor and said, whoa, that's incredible. We vowed there and then pretty much that we must explore this. So it took a few years actually to get a project in place, but the European Space Agency, ESA, very kindly funded us to explore this. And yeah, Planet Labs, with their SkySat constellation, a constellation of around 20 very high-resolution satellites, optical, they're able to capture videos. We were capturing 30-second videos. They can capture up to 90 seconds. They're 30 frames a second. They're HD wow. quality. They're sort of, you know, I think they're 2560 by 1080. So it's, you know, kind of thing you might get with a smartphone. And once we'd chosen the sites where we wanted to collect data, and this is the critical thing, we're back to location, location, location. The site you saw on the Indus River in Pakistan, it took me a lot of time on Google Earth, poking around, trying to find the right place. But once I could see from the historic Google Earth imagery that during periods of high flow, we had roughness features that were large enough that they could be seen in satellite-derived imagery, we kind of pretty much knew it was going to work. So we did do some calibration and validation measurements in the UK and in Australia. We got results within about 5%,
wow, some of them okay.
1%, which when you buy a new sensor, it gives you results within 5% or 1%. You're pretty happy. So when it's a proof of concept, measuring a river from space, we were ecstatic. We couldn't believe what we'd achieved. But back to the Pakistan one. So we got these video acquisitions during the major flood event that was, I think it was August, September 2022. And we got about six of these over a period of time. They all processed really, really well. We got really nice velocimetry. What we end up with, I'll describe it because you can't see it. You end up with a video, and on that video, once you've processed, you have velocity vectors, which are arrows indicating the direction and speed of the flow of the river. And we don't just get one. Such was the quality of the video and the quality of the processing software we're using, we were able to get anything up to 21 independent readings of velocity across the surface of the river. And we were able to do it in three different locations within a single frame of video, which was a kind of self-validation and calibration exercise, because if they were the same and if they represented velocities that we would expect, then we were confident in the results. And why I say that is, sadly, we didn't have the budget to go out to Pakistan to do any validation. The other thing we didn't have for Pakistan, and this leads us to another important next step for this, we did not have cross-sections. So we chose a place where we knew we had a very good surface condition with the right features for this method to work, but we didn't have a cross-section. So we weren't able to calculate discharge. We were able to produce some very compelling results that showed us the surface velocity, and we could see the distribution of velocity across the river, and we could see the changes in velocity as the river rose and fell over a period of time. But frustratingly, we didn't have that cross-section.
Would you be able to sort of infer cross-section if you had a time series for that site at different water levels? You'd be able to see, maybe use elevation models and what have you to get as close as possible to the river edge. And then is there any way that you can infer from the way that the riffles and pools lay out in the river?
There's a career for you in hydrometry, aren't you? two excellent suggestions, and the answer to both is yes. Yeah, the first one I think has been done on lakes and reservoirs, so they call it hypsometry, and that's okay. by analysing a series of images. They can be radar, they can be optical, and you can see the surface area. You can see the wetted surface area. If you also know the water's height, you can then start to build up a kind of relationship and a volume relationship for your reservoir or your lake based upon the expanse of the water surface and the height. You know, you end up with this kind of virtual 3D model, if you like. The same thing would be possible for rivers, yeah. We haven't done it yet. We're keen to explore whether we could do it. And I think with high resolution imagery and with radar, it should certainly be possible. The second one was, yeah, around whether you can infer anything from the structure of the water surface. And yeah, there's some researchers in the US were doing something on this, and they had recognized that the size of those turbulent structures could indicate what was happening beneath. And sadly, we weren't funded, but we had a really nice concept with the University of Sheffield for using drones to do the same thing, to, you know, the roughness of the water surface looks the way it does because of a certain number of, you know, factors, and the roughness of the bed will be one. The relationship between depth and width can be another one. But yeah, it should be possible, and it will be exciting next step to be able to read that water surface to understand what's happening underneath.
Yeah, that really would be awesome. Just to keep with the poo sticks analogy, being a bear of very little brain, I'm a little bit confused about how the roughness features give you information about flow. So if it's a big log or something going through the image, I totally understand how that, because it's something solid that's going through the image at a given speed. So, but if you have some foam that's there because there's a great big boulder underneath and there's a sort of a wave has been set up in the river or whatever, how that, my understanding is that doesn't actually go anywhere. That's basically, that's there for the duration of the flood as the water goes over that boulder. So how do you get a flow vector from that?
All right. Well, it's a three-word answer, Alan. The answer is location, location, location again. But no, you're absolutely right. In some rivers, you will get these static features, and certainly, you know, upland rivers where there's boulders and rocks on the bottom will create these, you know, standing waves and roughness features that aren't going anywhere. So, you know, one of the things we were careful to ensure with this research was that we chose places where that wasn't going to be that much of a problem. And it's kind of easier with the drone, because with the drone, you're looking at a smaller zone of the river. And so you can quite easily position your drone in one place and say, hey, oh, we've got bias because we've got those kind of static features. And then you can move it somewhere else to try and avoid them. With the satellite, in fact, generally, it's generally the case, certainly for the sites that we made observations at, that because the river was large and it was wide and it was deep, there weren't that many of those features, but it was certainly something we were wary of. The other thing to say, I mean, it's getting a bit geeky and nerdy, is the way the software processes, the software we were using is actually quite good at picking out moving features from a whole load of static features. And it even, and I love this, it allows the user to look at the results and say, no, I don't think they're right, and correct them, which is great, because, you know, I don't think we put quite enough faith in our own ability to interpret and get things right, when sometimes computers get it wrong. So you know, the software is called HydroStiv. I'm not here to promote it, but I would say we use it and it works really well. But I really like the fact that it allows me to go in and say, no, on that, you know, in that case, you've got it wrong, and here's how to correct it.
So is it pretty much automated using, I don't know, computer vision or AI, God forbid, AI or something? And then you get, it sounds like it does its thing and plops out a result, and you're able to go through it and then sense check it and that sort of
thing. Yeah, so you load your video. What you actually do is you give it some sort of guidance in terms of showing it the direction of flow, and you draw a little grid of lines. And what it does is it tracks variations in brightness along those lines. So you can imagine if it's foam moving with the flow, you're going to see a movement along those lines. If it's a static feature, you'll see it stationary. And hopefully you can pick one from the other. You know, if it's completely stationary, you know it's not something you want to track if it's moving. you can work it like that. But yeah, it does do that. But then one of the things, so having come from the Environment Agency, I'm very interested in operational solutions. I'm interested in, I'll probably get in trouble for saying this because I work for a research institute, but I'm actually more interested in seeing tools and techniques that I've developed being used in the real world than I am in being published in papers. But yeah, I think where we're at the moment, these methods have been proven to work really, really well. They've got huge potential in terms of flooding because we can safely get observations where we couldn't otherwise. And I will also want you to think about situations where the river's expanded and flowing all over the floodplain. It's really difficult to measure that floodplain flow, but with the drone, you can just fly it over and you can do that. So you need your cross-section, but that's where the kind of obstacle to this is at the moment, that this software is great, but I call this deconstructed flow gauging, that all the information that you need to make the measurement isn't obtained from the drone video. So you have to bring it in from other sources. So what you have to currently do is find a cross-section from somewhere else. You have to adjust it for the water surface height, because the height of the water surface will be different on the day in which you obtain your drone video to the day on which you obtain the cross-section. And so your cross-sectional area will be different. So you need that. And then you've got to sort of put this all into the mixing pot and stir it around before you... And the other thing you need to know, we talked about how ADCPs give us a velocity profile. So that what we mean by that is, in most rivers, as you move up from the bed, which generally has roughness caused by rocks and cobbles and gravel and whatever else is on the bottom, towards the surface, the water speed generally gets faster. And we see a sort of a curve, we call it a velocity profile. If we're measuring with an ADCP, with the acoustic instrument we talked about earlier on, we're actually measuring that whole thing. So we don't need to worry about it. We've measured it, right? But if we're only looking at the surface, we don't know what it is. So we need to know the relationship between surface velocity, what's happening underneath. So again, we will go and mine our ADCP data, if we have it for the location, and extract a relationship between that surface velocity and what's happening underneath. If we don't have ADCP data, we can use theory. And the French researchers came up with some delightfully simple guidance on this. They said, if the surface is rough and turbulent looking, and your river's probably a little bit shallow, you multiply your surface velocity by 0.75. If the water surface is kind of smooth and glassy, a bit like the Thames and other major UK rivers in times of low to moderate flow, you multiply by 0.95. And the bit I really like is, if it's somewhere in between or you don't really know, use 0.85, which I love for its simplicity. But it's been tested. It's been proven to be actually pretty effective. So if you've got it, you derive it empirically from measurements. If you haven't, you can use that. So that the cross-section is essential. That velocity profile is very desirable, but you can still get a good indication without it. But bolting all these bits and pieces together, to come back to my earlier point, is quite a faff. It's quite time-consuming. And that's where I think, software and data systems could be developed that really help to ease the pain there. So I'm now going to give a big plug to a project that I'll be in big trouble if I don't mention, because it's the UKCH-led Floods and Droughts Research Infrastructure Project, also abbreviates happily to FDRI. But FDRI is a big investment from NERC. It's around about £38 million to really deliver a big improvement to observational hydrology. So it's turning three subcatchments, the Tweed, the Severn, and the Chess, which is a small river in just north of London, into basically open air laboratories where we can do lots of experiments and invite lots of other people in to do experiments. But a big part of this will also be a digital side of it. So it's going to try and address these challenges. So, when I say, oh God, it's difficult getting my ADCP data and merging it with this drone video and then working out the surface, that's the challenge these people want to deal with. So my colleagues at UKCH and the other partners involved are going after that challenge. And hopefully out of it will come a system that enables these measurements to be made much more easily.
And how long is that project lasting?
Oh, gosh. It's a multi-year project. I think I should know this, and I'll be in trouble for not remembering the dates. But we're in the sort of design and implementation phase at the moment, which is about another 2 to 3 years. I think it's then funded for about 5 years, but we very much hope it will continue beyond that. because that's it is excellent, though.
Yeah, just having that time span is really good for getting, you know, meaningful results, being able to use the measurements for things in the future that require a time series. So.
Absolutely. And I think another objective of the project is to help develop new methods and new techniques and to address. So another consideration as we move to these non-contact methods, and we haven't talked about radar yet, but you can use radar as well as video. You need to know this cross-section, which I keep talking about, but you also need to know if it's stable. Does it change over time? Because I don't know if you've seen any of there are some incredible videos on YouTube of the impacts of Hurricane Helene in the US. Mm. And I would describe it as not just a hydrological event, it's a geological event. The rivers, some of the rivers have gone from being 20 meters wide to being 100 meters wide. Bridges, railways, roads, small towns are gone. They're wiped off the map. Tragically, quite a few people, well, I believe over 200 people lost their lives. But that's an extreme example. But that's an example of where the river channel itself is changing dramatically as a result of a high flow. So we need to start to improve our understanding of those kind of processes. If we can do that through Earth observation techniques, that's really great. So last week I attended two workshops in Oxford with multiple different people from different organizations, but a couple of people from European Space Agency were there. And I was presenting that challenge that, you know, the floods we're getting now are of such magnitude and the impact is so great that if we had, you know, I talked at the start about in permanent river flow gauging stations, of which the Environment Agency has about 1,700. Those things exist in the US, they exist in Spain, but they will not exist if they're impacted by a Helene type event or the Valencia flood. They'll be washed away. Yeah. So then you're left blind. Can you get out there with a drone in the height of one of those events? Maybe, but it's kind of unlikely. So I, you know, my current sort of soapbox mantra theme is, you know, Earth observation satellite techniques, we really need to be pushing these techniques to enable us to try and measure these events, which unfortunately I think are only going to get worse. But I think it also highlights, you know, the work we did with Planet Labs, we couldn't have done if we weren't using very high resolution data. And that very high resolution data tends to come from the commercial sector at the moment. So, you know, whether it's optical or whether it's radar, it's coming from companies like Planet, like Maxar. On the radar side of things, it's ISAI, it's Umbra, it's Capella. The capability of these companies are extraordinary, but bringing that capability into the research domain and developing the solutions that can actually measure, quantify these events, and it's not just for scientific interest, it's also to try to improve our ability to get warnings out, because, you know, as hydrologists, anytime we see a hydrological event like a flood that's costing lives, that's very painful. We don't like to see that. So, yeah, if we can be developing tools and techniques that even in those very rapid onset floods can help to issue the warnings or to validate the warnings and say, no, this really is a serious event and you really do need to move, you know, that would be a really great outcome.
Now that's really interesting. And I think there's probably an entire episode just around the use of optical and radar in doing these methods. And we may have to come back and revisit this at some point in the future. But in the talk that you sent me earlier today, you were talking about how two of the things that you wanted to impart was enthusiasm and ambition. And I think, well, we've definitely had the enthusiasm. It's been brilliant talking with you. And I was going to ask you about ambition and sort of what you think the big unsolved problems are that you want to do next. But I think you've covered that really nicely in the answer to your last point. So I think, although I could go on and just keep listening to you talk about this for ages, I think we ought to wrap it up. But thank you, Nick, so much for coming on the podcast and talking about this. It's really fascinating. If people want to get in touch with you, what would be the best way of doing that?
Oh, crikey, there's a challenge. I do still have a Twitter account. You can find me. I don't look at it very much anymore. I have moved to the what do they call it? Blue Sky.
Yes,
I've only just moved there, but yeah, and you can find me Nick Everard at Blue Skies Social. I'm also on LinkedIn, but I mean, just search me on LinkedIn. You'll find me, I'm sure. I don't know how to describe my,
that's great,
my LinkedIn user profile. I don't know how they do that. But yeah, you can find me through those things. And I'm happy to talk to anyone who's inspired by this. And one of my challenges, actually, you know, beyond advancing technology, I want to get more people going into this measurement thing. So, you know, increasingly at hydrology conferences, it's become a theme to say, put your hands up if you're doing modeling, and lots of hands go up, and then say, put your hand up if you're doing measurements, and way fewer hands go up. And we need to address that, because the measurements underpin the modeling.
Yeah.
And the measurements, hopefully, as has been conveyed in this discussion, like, the measurement stuff is really exciting. It's really fun. You know, I'm having conversations with European Space Agency, with high-tech satellite providers. You know, it's exciting. And tomorrow I'm out flying my drone and driving a remote control boat on the River Thames. You know, it's fun and exciting. So, yeah, get involved is the final message, I guess.
Definitely. So that's a brilliant place to leave it. Thank you very much, Nick. Cheers.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us today on the GeoMob podcast. We hope you enjoyed the discussion. You can get the show notes over on the website, which is at thegeomob.com. And while you're there, you can sign up for our monthly newsletter and find links to our accounts on Mastodon and LinkedIn, so that you can stay up to date on all our upcoming events. We hope to see you at an event soon.